January 6th, 2018. We're going to go out of order on the agenda today. We're going to open the first hearing on House Bill 4082. Called Representative Paluso and Christina, and I'm sorry I can't read that, and Peter Sprengelmeier.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. As was mentioned, this is House Bill 4082, brought to us by Representative Paluso. It directs the Oregon Youth Authority to administer the Juvenile Justice Information System in partnership with county juvenile departments through a steering committee, and it also allows disclosure of certain juvenile records for certain specified purposes, such as program planning, and it declares an emergency. There is a dash one amendment which specifies that any person obtaining these records is responsible for preserving their confidentiality. There is a minimal fiscal impact on the dash one and no revenue impact on the dash one.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Rep. Barker, members of the committee. My name is Carla Paluso. I proudly represent Gresham, House District 50. Today, I'd like to have a conversation with you around the Juvenile Justice Information System. As you know, leaders in the Oregon Youth Authority and our county juvenile departments are committed to evidence-based practices, data-informed decisions, and developing programs that improve public safety. All of these efforts depend on sound research and evaluation, as well as external validation of their data tools and practices. Recently, the Youth Authority became aware that the state law was silent on the practice of sharing data for the purpose of research and evaluation. Silence put the practice of sharing data in legal jeopardy. House Bill 4082, with the dash one amendment, is a fix to this issue. It puts in law that data can be shared for the purposes of research and evaluation. Sometimes we as legislators have an opportunity to make a small change in a law that has a positive impact. This is such a bill. I encourage you to join me in supporting House Bill 4082 and to continue to support the Youth Authority and county juvenile departments in using research and evaluation to evolve and focus their practices on the public safety outcomes we all want them to achieve. Should you have any questions, I will defer to the experts who are waiting to talk with you, Christina McMahon and Peter. Oh, yeah, Peter.
Sprengelmeier
are the co-chairs of the Juvenile Justice Information Steering Committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Peter Sprengelmeier. I am the Assistant Director for OIA of Community Services, so I deal with all kids who are outside of our facilities. I'm also the co-chair and OIA representative on the JJ Steering Committee. I'd like to echo the comments that Representative Paluso put forward. The juvenile justice system in Oregon is a collaboration amongst OIA, county juvenile departments, and community partners. Part of what makes that system work is that within that collaboration, we all enter data into a common shared database. That shared data system allows for ease of communication and ease of coordination for kids as kids move, especially between county juvenile departments, OIA, and community partners. We've been building this system since the 1990s and have over 20 years of data in this aggregate. For individual case management, this system works really well. We're able to collapse data and look at what kids have done, but also look back at the 20 years of historical data to look at what similar kids have done in the history and find the appropriate placements for those kids and what the kids of similar histories have done and been successful at or less successful at. And so for individual movement of cases, this works really well. The difficulty, as Representative Paluso pointed out, is the law is silent in terms of our ability to give out aggregate data. And aggregate data and the sharing of aggregate data is important to us for audit functions, to work with funders, but also as we do research projects to demonstrate and check that research with outside external review partners. Not only do we want to share that aggregate data, but in the process of sharing that data, it's important that that data remain privileged and protected since it is a part of a juvenile record. And that's what we're seeking with this House bill, is an attempt to both allow us to share that aggregate data, but do that in a way that maintains the privilege and the safety around that. Our understanding is there's no protection in law currently, and we are seeking that through this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, and Vice Chair
Olson.
I'm Christina McMahon. I'm the director of the Clackamas County Juvenile Department, but today I am here in my capacity as one of the co-chairs of the JGIS Steering Committee. I'm here representing, as co-chair of the JGIS Steering Committee, I represent the 36 county juvenile department directors in the state of Oregon. I'm also here today to emphasize the critical nature of the JGIS partnership that we're about to talk about a little more, and especially emphasize the important role that the 36 county juvenile departments play in that partnership. So not to go too far down memory lane, but this history that we have of our JGIS partnership dates back over 20 years ago when Senate Bill 1 was passed and the Oregon Youth Authority was formed. The leaders at the time, both at the county level and at the newly formed Youth Authority, were visionary, and they decided to create a system, a statewide system, that would allow all of the county's juvenile departments and the state agency to share data. That might not sound like a big deal now, but 20 years ago, that was unheard of. So I just wanted you to know that what we have here in Oregon is very special. There are only a handful of states in the United States that have such a system. So that is another reason why this partnership is so important. The other thing to emphasize is we hear a lot about collaboration, but when you think about starting from ground zero with 36 counties and a brand new state agency, what it took to make that happen was collaboration on steroids. So I can't emphasize enough how critical that is to the work that we all do in the juvenile justice system. I wanted to also make sure, and Peter touched on this quite a bit, but from a county perspective, OYA and the counties really depend on our juvenile justice information system in terms of it being our operational system. What I mean by that is it is literally the lifeblood of our operations. We utilize the system to track critical information about the reformation of the young people that we are entrusted to serve, and also information that helps us keep our local community safe. We also use it to provide critical information to law enforcement, judges, treatment providers, schools, and also to make important decisions that are often really time sensitive. And we use it to protect the rights, to make sure that we're protecting the rights of victims, we're tracking that we're honoring the rights of victims, and we're making sure that we have information that we can share to keep them safe. The other thing that's really important about JGIS is the governance structure. We have what's called the JGIS Steering Committee, and you will find it in the Oregon Administrative Rules Chapter 416, Division 180, which is entitled Administration of the Juvenile Justice System. As exciting as that might not sound to you, it's exciting to me. So what's great about that administrative rule is it contains the governance structure for the JGIS Steering Committee. So going back to the vision of 20 plus years ago, the leadership at OYA back then decided that it was so important to show good faith in terms of beginning this new relationship with the counties that they went ahead and created a governance structure in the steering committee that gave 5 votes to county juvenile departments and 3 votes to the state agency. And to my knowledge, during that entire history, we've never had a time where we haven't been able to collaborate and work through any issues that we had. So I think that shows you that it's a testament to how strong the partnership has been. The other piece about the steering committee is the administrative rule clearly outlines what the responsibilities of the steering committee are. They include, they're not limited to, but include development of data collection information and processes, assignment of duties between partnering state and local agencies, determination of system features, including prioritizing development and implementation of such features, and then importantly for the discussion today around data sharing, final approval of JGIS policy and procedures and decisions related to implementation and maintenance of the system and upgrades and training, and then also allows the steering committee to appoint different advisory groups as necessary to reach these goals. So we do have several different advisory groups, one being the JGIS Data and Evaluation Committee, going back to the important work that Representative Peluso and Peter Sprengelmeyer shared about the research capacity that's needed and the work that's being done to make sure that the services and the approaches that we're using with juveniles in our state are effective and are working. So that is a critical, that's just one example of many different committees that we have. The other thing I wanted to make sure is that you know that one of the main parts, I just mentioned it, was the policy and procedure development for the operation of JAGIS. That's contained in OAR 416-180-0040, and that's the administrative rule that specifies that the steering committee will define a process where JAGIS policy and procedures are developed and approved. JAGIS policy and procedure will be contained within JAGIS and made available electronically. Each participating state and county agency is responsible to ensure that its daily operations adhere to the standards contained within such policies and procedures. So the steering committee has a pretty important role in making sure that we are safeguarding data, safeguarding the privacy of the youth that we're entrusted with, and also to make sure that we're setting policies that are keeping in alignment with the goals of the juvenile justice system. So that is all I have for you today. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Are there any questions? Representative Gorsuch, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This could be, well, Carla, you too, but this could be for anybody on the panel. So as I understand it, then the makeup of the JAGIS steering committee, that's eight altogether? Is it five and three?
There's eight voting members.
Okay.
And then there are other partner agencies that are involved, like, for example, Department of Corrections.
Okay, so they might be involved then in consulting with the steering committee?
They're on the steering committee, but they are not voting members.
Okay, and their role? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, may I follow?
Please, yes,
okay.
You may.
So what is their role? Are they advisors, or how do they fulfill their role on the board or the committee?
They contribute to the discussions and the decision-making and help us inform mm-hmm. our decision-making. So they're part of the steering committee, but they don't have a voting membership.
Okay, and follow up. Is there any plan to change this steering committee in the near future that you know of?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, no, I don't know of any plan to change that. And I think people are really happy with the makeup of that committee and the process that it moves forward.
One last thing,
please,
Mr. Chair. Thank you. And finally, can somebody explain to me just how the process works for releasing information, since we're talking about the sharing of that information? Does either one of you would be fine?
Yeah. Chair Barker. Representative Gorsuch. Yes, we actually have, I brought four of them today. They're very lengthy. We have a lot of policies and procedures that we have created over the years, and we have extensive policies related to the release of information, who can do what. So for example, the Oregon Youth Authority is able to release information according to policies. County juvenile departments are allowed to release information according to these policies that are also formulated in alignment with the juvenile delinquency code provisions for records. So yes, we have extensive policies on that. So what usually comes to the steering committee are broader issues related to a research request from the outside. If, for example, somebody comes to the steering committee and wants to request Clackamas County's data, the steering committee cannot approve releasing Clackamas County's data. Clackamas County, that's my responsibility as director in Clackamas County. I would have to deal with that request and decide if we could honor the request.
So it sounds like there's pretty clear delineation of responsibility.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peluso, sorry, I have to do this in every committee I'm in. You know my never-ending quest to get to the bottom of the emergency clause. Please, what is the emergency? Am I missing what it is?
Chair Barker, Rep. Post, bottom line, we have been without adequate data for virtually ever. So, you know, the sooner we can make this happen, the sooner we can start gathering the data and information that we know how to improve the circumstances for our youth.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, panel.
Thank Thank you.
Next, I call Lynn Schroeder and Dina Yocorso or Colso.
While the panel's coming up, Mr. Chair, can I just make a comment?
Yes, please.
You know, I'm incredibly supportive of this bill, partially because OA has done a fantastic job with research and data and have used that to really move juvenile justice forward in the state of Oregon. And I think to Representative Post's question, we want to make sure that they can continue doing the work that they're doing and that it's very clear that the work that they're doing is not without outside the bounds of our statutes and rules right now. So I think we don't want to have to stop the research that's in progress to wait until the bill would go into effect without an emergency clause.
Okay, thank you. Please go ahead either in order you'd like.
I'm going to go run do that thing. So but I want to be back.
Okay.
So I will be back as quick as I can.
Thank you, Representative. Please go ahead and just remember to identify yourself for the
Thank
record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker and committee members. My name is Lynn Schroeder. I am the Juvenile Department Director for Washington County and a member of the Oregon Juvenile Director Department Directors Administrate. Excuse me. OJDDA. How's that? And I'm here in both capacities today. I will be brief because you've heard a lot about JGIS already, and you know that it's a unique and equal partnership between the counties and the state, and that this came out of a vision that people had about a better juvenile justice system, about doing what we can to help youth be successful and to protect communities. In Washington County, almost 97% of the referrals in our system are handled at a local level. Those youth never progress to the Oregon Youth Authority. So you can see my interest in an effective JGIS system to be able to use it for case management, to be able to use it to do evaluations effectively is critical. That's where all of our data is. The interest of OJDDA is to ensure that all counties, large and small, urban and rural, with all their diversity of needs and resources, have a voice in the management of JGIS through the steering committee, and that their interests are protected and honored. I'm happy to report that that's been the case from the beginning till now, and our hope is that the legislature will continue to support that level of collaboration and equality. Second, it is vitally important that we have the capacity to engage researchers and evaluators and share information with the public, our local public safety coordinating systems, to look at our data and ensure that we're managing the most effective juvenile system that possible. What we've learned on the local level over the last 20 years is that what can be effective, and we've taken steps to embrace that, implement that, and to use their resources to connect youth on a local level with resources, and then to prioritize the high-end, the expensive services for youth who are most risk to the community. The third thing is, it's essential that when any data is shared, that the confidentiality of youth be maintained. The youth we work with have had many hardships and traumas in their life. We want to minimize any collateral consequences that might occur through public exposure, and maintaining their confidentiality will give them the best chance to succeed and keep our communities safe. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Olson and Williamson, and members of the committee. My name is Dina Corso, and I am the Juvenile Services Division Director for Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 4082. I'm here to express Multnomah County's support in finding a legislative solution to ensure that both the Oregon Youth Authority and the county juvenile departments have access to data available in the Juvenile Justice Information System, JGIS, for research purposes. Multnomah County values the partnership with the Oregon Youth Authority and the other county juvenile departments in developing and maintaining a statewide data system. This data is integral in our efforts to measure outcomes, evaluate programs, and make changes when needed. We feel that it is important for this partnership and access to data to continue, and this bill will allow for that. I'm also here to share a couple of concerns that Multnomah County has on the record. We want to make sure that the Oregon Youth Authority continues to partner with the JGIS Steering Committee in developing and implementing oversight of the system. We have concerns that the bill's language of consultation will not require OYA to truly partner with the JGIS Steering Committee. We're happy to hear from the first panel that OYA plans to continue to work with the JGIS Steering Committee in partnership, and we hope that this committee will hold them to that standard. In addition, while it may be the intent to ensure sufficient representation of county juvenile directors on the JGIS Steering Committee, the current legislation does not codify that and leaves open the possibility of changing the membership. The current model makes sure that the voices of juvenile directors are sufficiently heard at the table. Again, we're happy to hear OYA commit to not changing the JGIS Steering Committee at this point. Currently, the JGIS system has many processes in place to make sure that sensitive data, including personally identifiable information about juvenile offenders, victim information, and other highly sensitive data is not inadvertently shared. We would also like for there to be agreements in place, including but not limited to the counties whose data is released. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer questions if there are any.
Did we have any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next call, Aaron Knott and Mary Sophia.
Hi there, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sophia. I am the legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm happy to be up here to offer a voice in support of the bill that you're currently hearing. When we first read this bill, we were, to be honest, my whole legislative committee was confused. We were like, wait a minute, but aren't they already doing that? And isn't it great? And so our perspective really is it makes sense to go ahead and pass this law to make sure that we're operating within the bounds of the law and also doing really important work. And so again, just a voice in support. And thank you so much for allowing me to come up and testify.
Thank you.
And thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice, likewise here in support of House Bill 4082. The Department of Justice shares the commitment of the Youth Authority to a data-driven, best practice justice system, and we recognize that that requires an analysis of the data. However, in our need to analyze that data, we cannot allow ourselves to lose sight of the fact that this data pertains to our juvenile population. It is by its very nature very sensitive. And it's through that lens that I want to thank Representative Peluso, OIA, and really Legislative Council for meeting concerns about the privacy of this information fully and completely in the form of Dash 1 amendments that I believe take this bill from a concept that arguably left a loophole in the privacy protections for the individuals that will be the subject of this data to really bringing forward something that is truly privacy-centered that does provide us with the opportunity to really scrutinize this data in a way that will not damage the people being scrutinized. So thank you for the partnership and the quick response, and open for questions if there are any.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. And we have a dash.
Dash one.
When we have an amendment.
Yes, thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Just to go over what the Dash 1 amendment does, as was just mentioned, it does specify that the people obtaining these records are responsible for preserving their confidentiality. So that is now stressed within the Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment also modifies who these records may be disclosed to. It now provides in the Dash 1 for disclosure to a government agency, a public or private post-secondary institution of education, and any person that OYA, a county or a county juvenile department, has entered into an agreement for the disclosure of this information. So in the original bill, it specifies these records can be disclosed to a researcher, evaluator, or data analysis, and the Dash 1 provides some more specificity for those persons.
Thank you. Close the public hearing and open the work session.
Chair Barker, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 5th, 2018.
Representative Williamson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 5th, 2018. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none.
Chair Barker, I move House Bill 4082 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 4082 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that? Seeing none, if there's no objections, I move the bill. We'll move the bill down. And who would like to carry that bill? Probably Representative Peluso asked to be the carrier on that bill. Okay, open a public hearing on House Bill 4055.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. This is House Bill 4055 and was brought to us by Vice Chair Olson. House Bill 4055 modifies some of the duties of a driver when the driver has been involved in a collision resulting in damage to property, person, or domestic animal. Also, currently the law does not require a driver to perform these duties when the driver learns it has been involved in a collision after having already left the scene. House Bill 4055 requires drivers involved in these collisions who do not learn of the collision until after leaving the scene to comply as nearly as possible with these duties and to contact 911 if the collision resulted in physical injury or death. There's also a dash one amendment on OLIS, which modifies the mental state in these offense and removes the requirement to provide a driver's license number to an officer investigating the collision. And we do not yet have the fiscal information.
Thank you. Representative Olson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, the state representative from the Albany area. I do greatly appreciate this opportunity to come before you regarding House Bill 4055. When a person is driving and collides with something, the new law would require the person to stop and investigate what they have struck. Why are we here? Because of a tragic collision that occurred one October evening in 2013 that left two little girls dead, the Court of Appeals essentially told the legislature to fix the current hit-and-run statutes. Depending upon the result of the collision, whether it be damage to another vehicle, injury, or death of another person, damage to property, injury to a domestic animal, a person has certain duties that are already enumerated under current law. Let me just kind of touch a little bit on ORS 811-700 with you. That law addresses the collision involving damage to another vehicle or property. A person who is no longer at the scene of a collision and later discovers for the first time that they have been involved in a collision that resulted in property damage, the person is obligated to comply as much as possible with the requirements of the statute, such as finding the owner of the property damage and giving the relevant information. This does not include calling 911. ORS 811.705 addresses the injury or death to another person. If the person who is no longer at the scene of a collision and later discovers for the first time that they have been involved in a collision that resulted in injury or death, the person is required to comply with the requirements of the section as well as call 911 and give identifying information and location and approximate time of the crash. This would cover the Garcia Cisneros case with Anna and Abigail. There is a concern that the Fifth Amendment rights of the defendant in this bill may be violated. I defer that to Bracken McKee with the Washington County District Attorney's Office, who's sitting with me on my right. But I also want to introduce you to Anna and Abigail's mom and dad, too, as well, Susan and Tom, that were willing to come up and share a little bit with us. So at this point right now, Bracken, you're on.
Thank you. Chairman Barker and Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson, thank you for the opportunity. It's an honor for me to be here today with Tom and Susan Robinson, Anna and Abigail's parents. I want to call this Anna and Abigail's Law. And I want to talk about, in more detail, why we're here. The Court of Appeals identified a gap in the current hit-and-run law when they wrote, "The state may be right in identifying a statutory gap, but it is not our role to fill that gap for the legislature." Essentially, they invited you to fix the current law. I want to talk about what this law does and also what it doesn't do. It does two things. First, if a driver is involved in a collision, they need to investigate what they hit. Second, they have a responsibility to comply with the hit and run law if they've left the scene before they learned they were involved in a crash. It doesn't expand the current obligations that a driver has. It also doesn't expand who that information must be provided to. It simply changes the timing. So I want to talk about the Fifth Amendment. We've had 811-700 since 1983. During that time, that case has been that statute has been challenged once in State versus Monroe when it comes to a person's Fifth Amendment right. And I'll get to what the court in Monroe said in a second, but it's important to understand that nowhere in this bill do we change what information must be provided or change who that information must be provided to. It changes only the timing for providing that information to include drivers that become aware of a collision after they've left the scene. The current law already requires a driver to, quote, remain at the scene of an accident until a police officer has arrived and received required information. If all the people that you would normally give that information to are either deceased or unconscious. If Oregon's current hit and run law does not violate a driver's right against self-incrimination, neither does House Bill 4055. We know from State versus Monroe that Oregon's hit and run statute, as it stands, does not violate a defendant's right against self-incrimination. And again, like I said, this is the one case since 1983 that addresses this issue. And so we're talking about, 35 years of good law. There are other states that have similar provisions. And while they don't share Oregon's Article 1, Section 2, they have their equivalent and plus the Fifth Amendment. Utah does, Minnesota does, Washington, D.C. does. This is Anna and Abby. This picture was taken moments before their death. I want to talk about why this law is important, and it's important to understand that this involves real people. It's hard for someone to claim ignorance of their involvement of a crash when that crash involves another vehicle. What this law really is about is protecting our most vulnerable, the cyclist, the jogger, the small child who's chasing a ball, and maybe the next little girl in a leaf pile. Think about the hit and run law as the Oregon Court of Appeals has now defined it. You can be less than a block away, and only moments later in time, when you know that you've run over and seriously injured another person, and you have zero responsibility to help them. No responsibility to call 911. No responsibility to take steps that might save a child's life, or at the very least, lessen the emotional burden on a grieving family. There will be times when returning to the scene or picking up your phone to call 911 will literally mean the difference between life and death. Isn't that what we want? The current law, as defined by the Court of Appeals, allows for or even encourages plausible deniability. That is bad public policy. We can do better. Whether you're from Tracktown, USA, or Biketown, this is a law that protects the most vulnerable in our communities. It's a no-brainer. Oregonians are stronger when we look out for each other, when we do the right thing. And today I'm asking you to do the right thing and pass Anna and Abigail's law. It's been a real honor to get to know personally Tom and Susan Robinson the last few years. And I admire their grace, their resilience, and I'd now like to turn it over, Chairman Barker, to Susan Robinson.
Thank you.
Representative Barker and committee for allowing us to speak regarding our daughters, Anna and Abigail. This is Anna. When this photo was taken, she was 6 years old and had just entered the first grade at a new school. Her principal called me 3 weeks into school and shared with me what a great young lady Anna was and how grateful she was to have her be part of her, their school community. She wasn't telling me anything I didn't already know. I was and will forever be very proud of my girl. Anna was shy around those she didn't know, but energetic and a risk taker around those she felt comfortable with. She was a nurturer to her core, always taking care of her dolls and the littles in our neighborhood. She was strong, courageous, and extremely fast. The boys in our neighborhood loved challenging her foot races, and she smoked them every single time. She rode horses, climbed trees, and loved with her entire heart. She gave the best hugs, wrapping her arms around me, her mama, and squeezing with all of her might. She is my girl. This is Abigail, my stepdaughter, although in our family we never used the word step. When this photo was taken, Abigail was 11, a preteen. She had just started the sixth grade and was looking forward to being a real teenager, driving and going to college, which she had already been saving up for. Abigail was a dreamer, always trying to figure out what the next phase of her life was going to be like. She protected those who couldn't protect themselves. She stood up when no one else would, and she held tight to what she knew was right. She used her voice to not only share her ideas, but also to entertain. She was a theater kid toward the core, and she loved being on stage. She is my bright star. On October 20th of 2013, not even a month after these photos were taken, my girls were involved in an accident in front of my house. Anna and Abigail were doing what many kids did that day due to the odd dry weather we were having. They were playing in leaves and hiding. At the same time, a 19-year-old girl driving south on our street drove through that pile of leaves after being prompted by her passengers, her boyfriend and brother. She did not see my girls in the leaves prior to driving through them, but did not stop after she knew she had hit something. What happened in front of my house that day was a perfect storm that changed our lives and our hearts forever. Anna, being little, went to heaven instantly. Although it breaks my heart that I can no longer hold her, I am grateful that she felt no pain that day. She was playing, and then she was in heaven. Abigail, being a little bigger and having one last job to do before she joined her sister, was life flighted to Randall Children's Hospital, where a team of doctors and nurses found perfect matches to her organs and tissue. She gave life to 4 people and sight to 1 with her organ tissue donations. I remember standing on the side of the road, waiting to hold Anna one last time. I was told initially that it was a possibility once the 30-plus officers and firefighters, figured out what had happened. When the coroner arrived, I remember having a conversation with her and one of the detectives. Because they did not know what happened, there wasn't a car or driver that stopped, it was now a crime and it needed to be solved. With that said, they informed me that Anna was evidence, and I couldn't hold or see her. I remember telling them that I wasn't going to press charges, because I knew in my heart that it was an accident and that the person caused it was going to feel horrible when they found out what happened. I remember my broken heart feeling bad for them. A few days later, we found out that wasn't the case. Approximately 5 minutes after my girls were hit, one of the passengers in the car rode his bike to the scene where he engaged with my husband, who was frantic and in the process of calling 911. He rode his bike back home, not even a half a block from the scene, and told the driver and the other passenger what had happened. They hit two small children. At that point, they made a decision that impacted our family in a way that is immeasurable. They got in the car and they left. Went to Walmart, went and got ice cream, came back to their house, passing the scene one more time, and went to bed. The next day, they washed their car, attempting to get rid of the evidence that may have still been there. With the tip from a neighbor, the driver and the passengers were questioned by the police a couple days later, and truth was revealed. I remember thinking I was grateful that we knew what had happened. I was devastated by the news, but at least we knew. There were no unanswered questions, so I thought. The driver of the car pled not guilty to the charge of hit and run for failing to identify yourself as the driver in a deadly crash. There was to be a trial where, over the course of many days, we had to relive the worst nightmare again and again in excruciating, stark detail and in public. On January 31st of 2014, the public, in the form of a jury, found her guilty with little deliberation of two counts of felony hit and run for failing to identify herself as a driver in a deadly crash. The driver made a horrible decision on October 20th, and the consequences to that behavior was being found guilty by a jury on that day. After the sentencing, I forgave her and asked the judge for her to receive no jail time. She was young, and I knew that if I didn't forgive her, that I would be held hostage by my anger and bitterness for the rest of my days. She said she was sorry, and that she wished she would have made different decisions. I believed her, and I wanted to believe that she would do good in this world in honor of my girls, and she would remember them every moment of her life. She was sentenced to 3 years of formal probation and 250 hours of community service. Months later, there was an appeal brought forth. I remember distinctly the sick feeling in my gut when Washington County Prosecutor Bracken McKee called to let us know we were once again heartbroken and couldn't understand how it could be possible that anyone would feel the justice wasn't served that day in the courtroom when she was found guilty. She knew she caused injury to someone minutes after the accident and made a conscious decision not to return. Bracken explained the loophole in the law, that because the girls weren't asking for help, she had no obligation to return. That made no sense to me because they weren't able to ask for help. Anna was already in heaven. She was no longer there, and Abigail wasn't conscious, nor did she ever regain consciousness. He went on to talk about the letter of the law versus the nature of the law. I remember feeling so sad that the two didn't match. And once again, we had to relive the tragedy in public light with news media outside of our door. We were in limbo for years, wondering what would happen next. On May 3rd of last year, I once again received a call from Bracken letting me know that the conviction was overturned and the appeal won because Oregon law does not require a defendant to return to the scene of an accident after he or she has left the scene and later learns that he or she was involved in an accident that injured or killed another person. This was the letter of the law, and that was it. I'm not only a mother, but I have also been a teacher for the past 17 years, and I've worked with hundreds of children throughout my life. Two of the greatest lessons I feel we can teach our children is knowing what how our actions impact others and to be empathetic to one another. You know the scenario. A child is running on the playground and runs into another child, but instead of stopping, they keep going with total disregard to the other child. Countless times I have guided my students and my own children through the process of checking in with those that accidentally hurt. When involved in an accident, whether on the playground or with siblings, doing everyday things, teaching kids to have empathy for others is so important. Teaching kids to own their behavior, whether it was an accident or not, is so important. The countless teachable moments that I have engaged in throughout my years of working with kids came to the forefront of my mind when learning about this loophole in the law. Imagine if no one ever kept kids accountable for their actions out on the playground when bumps and bruises were caused by accidents. Imagine if there was no empathy amongst our kids with those around them. I have no doubt that if the driver came back that night, I would have hugged her and we would have moved forward together. If she would have come back, I would have held Anna. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. And the way the current law stands, she had no obligation to identify herself as the person who was involved in the accident. This has caused her family a tremendous amount of added grief in a situation where our grief is already immeasurable. My ask for all of you today is to consider what the right thing to do is after finding out you're involved in an accident, and in that, consider closing the loophole in the current law. In making this change, someone in the future, already trying to survive their perfect storm, will not be faced with what we have had to go through for the last 4 years. Years of reliving our tragedy. If the law changes, our girls will have had a small piece in making that happen. And that will make us very proud. I can't watch Abigail on the stage anymore. And I can't watch Anna ride her big horse, Diva. But what I could say is that my girls helped change the law. 6 months after our girls went to heaven, we decided that we didn't want our lives to be marked by the tragedy that happened on that day. We wanted people to think of our girls and think of the love and joy that they had shared. With that, we started a movement that was begun by them on our marriage of sharing Love Rocks, river rocks with fabric hearts on them. Love Rocks are found by people or given to people when they least expect them. And each rock shares a little bit of our daughter's love and joy. They have been spread over 7 continents over the past 4 years. And because of them and many other reasons, when people say our girls' names, they smile. We now live a life where their baseline emotion is sadness. Our hearts hurt every second of every day. Through making a choice to focus on our girls' love and joy, we have found the ability to see the light that their legacy has brought so many. We are so grateful for this light because it, along with our faith and trust in God, has helped us to survive through our grief. A perfect fall day for me now is when I go to the farmer's market in our town and a young child yells, "Look, it's Anna and Abby's mom." My girls will never be forgotten. This past fall, November 13th to be exact, Anna would have been 11. Preteen, as I'm sure she would have told us many times like her sister did. This is the first year that it was hard for me to imagine what my girl would want on her special day. I'm sure baby dolls would be something of the past. This year, we decided to celebrate by showing her little sister, who's 2, all of Anna's favorite places. The zoo, our local coffee shop where she always had this favorite treat she always had to have, and dinner with her best friend's family where we toasted her with milkshakes, vanilla, which is her favorite. On December 27th, Abigail would have turned 16. This is a big one for us, because I have no doubt whatsoever that she would have been studying diligently and practicing every chance she got so that she could get her driver's license and be the best driver ever. On Abigail's special day, her dad, her oldest sister, 2 of her best friends, and I spent the morning sharing her organ donation story with the employees of the DMV. I share with them that I knew that I needed to be there that day on her 16th birthday because that's where I would have been. We left them a big basket of Love Rocks for those who came in to get their driver's test that day. A few days later, I received a message from a mom who knew our story well. She had gone to the DMV with her son on this 27th so he could take his test. She shared how excited he was when he was given one of Abigail's Love Rocks. He said it was a sign that he had to pass just for her. I have no doubt that my girl would have passed her test on the first time try. And she would have been a responsible driver and taken it very seriously. Thank you all so much for allowing us to share our story. No matter what happens today and in the future, we will always continue to live a life that honors our girls by sharing love and joy. They have taught us, along with so many others, what it truly means to live a life love-drenched. We are, and will forever be, extremely blessed to be their parents. Thank you.
Thank you. We plan to try to move the bill. We don't have the fiscal, so we cannot move it today. We're going to have we have an amendment that we will put in. I want to thank you profusely for coming down and going through this again. I've been here. This is my 16th year. I've served on this committee. I've seen countless victims come in and testify and give just horrendous testimony. You're, I have to tell you, the bravest victim witness I've seen in all those years. And it's hard to listen as well. So thank you very much. Really appreciate your testimony. Thank you, Bracken, for coming down.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I hate to introduce a trivial question at the moment, but I'm a little curious if I could ask the council. In terms of a property situation, there's no limit on the value of the property as there is in other issues. Is there?
I think that's correct. If you damage property, right, there's a, I don't.
That's the state of the current law, and this doesn't change that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. Did you want to add anything else, sir?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Mary?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mary Sophia, and I'm the legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. First and foremost, my committee and I extend our deepest condolences to the Dieter Robinson family. Listening to their story reminds me how there is absolutely a human toll when it comes to the law, and the work that everyone does here is so incredibly important, and so I appreciate that. I'm here to essentially briefly outline the concerns that my organization does have with the current way that the bill's drafted. The concerns that we have are purely legal in nature, and we do not in any way seek to minimize the very real tragedy that befell that family. I did submit written testimony that outlines the concerns that we have. I will briefly put them on the record, and I am happy to engage in further discussion with Representative Olson and the stakeholders that he worked with on the language. If there's time in the session, we would be more than happy to engage in that conversation. If there's not, we would be very happy to come to the table, and we believe that a work group would be beneficial before this law rolls out to fix the statute in the way that they're meaning to. The first piece that I want to outline for the committee is the mental states. The current mental state outlined in the bill draft is essentially knowing or reason to believe. The current state of the law is that knowledge is required. We understand that the reason why they're making a change in this situation is to not just loop in people who have knowledge that they've been in an accident, but to also loop in people who are essentially ostriching or intentionally disregarding the fact that they may have been involved in an accident. We understand that. The amendment and the current bill draft use language that is not what we would call model penal code language. In the law, there are four types of mental states that commonly apply, intentionally being the highest, followed by knowledge, followed by reckless, and followed by criminal negligence. Our position is, in order to get at the position or to get at the conduct where someone chooses to disregard they were in an accident, could likely be addressed by recklessness and not the language in either the current bill or the amendment. And we do think a discussion is further warranted in that situation. I do want to put on the record that anything lower, such as criminal negligence, could loop in people who truly did not know they were in an accident, and we simply want them to have been aware. And so that's one of the first concerns that we have. The second concern is we do believe that the language that's used in a couple of different pieces or in the first two statutes, quote, immediately complies nearly as possible with the requirements of the statute, is legally vague. And when I say legally vague, I mean that it does two things. One, it's unclear to a motorist involved in an accident, if they have to return to the scene, what do they actually need to do to comply as much as possible? The way that this is written currently, it leaves a lot of discretion to the police to issue citations. It leaves a lot of discretion to the prosecution to charge. And then ultimately, it puts a really tough question to the fact finder to determine what is nearly as possible. From a practical legal standpoint, the language will likely open the statute up to challenges for vagueness in the trial courts when someone believes they've reasonably complied, but they're still prosecuted. And we just want to tag this and flag this as something that needs to be addressed before the law rolls out. Hand in hand with that issue is the temporal issue. Not only is the bill unclear on what actual compliance means for people who realize only later that they were in an accident, but the bill doesn't address what a person is supposed to do if they realize days later they were in an accident. The bill is silent as to what would fulfill as much as possible or fulfill compliance as nearly as possible, and we believe that the temporal issues need to be addressed. And lastly, we do believe that this provision of the statute does implicate the Fifth Amendment. I'm not sitting here telling you that this law is unconstitutional, but what I am saying is it's likely that this requirement as written without further address would open the statute up to challenges under the Fifth Amendment in the trial courts, meaning when you have a statute that requires someone call 911 to make a report regarding a prior behavior, As a 5-year practitioner myself and going to law school, my job has been to flag and essentially flag legal issues. And I'm flagging this for you here today because I think it's important for you to know that this provision is questionable in nature. Thank you so much for listening to my testimony today. I understand how incredibly difficult it was for the Robinson family to come. Thank you, Representative Olson, for allowing me to have multiple discussions with you over this. And thank you, committee, for your time.
And thank you for bringing up, I mean, the reason we're here is because of something technically missing from the law that the Court of Appeals spotted and asked us to fix. But the Court of Appeals has ruled in cases that negligence applies to hit-and-run cases. So.
And my committee, and I can only speak for Chair Barker, members of the committee, I can only speak for the legal analysis that my legislative committee has done. And again, my legislative committee is made up of a bunch of dedicated lawyers who have full-time jobs, and they volunteer and they come sit with me to help give our organization direction. Okay. When we were having a discussion about what kind of mental state makes sense in this specific law based on this specific case, we landed on recklessness because recklessness is when you are essentially we believe that recklessness gets at someone who is intentionally trying to disregard something. So recklessness means that you should have been aware of something. Criminal negligence is, and actually I have it open and I want to make sure I'm giving you the. Forgive me, I want to give you the actual model penal code language. Thank you.
Thank you for your patience. So ORS 161085 outlines definitions with respect to culpability. Recklessly means, when used with respect to a result or to a circumstance described by statute, means that a person is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that a circumstance exists. So in this case, that means that the circumstance existing would be that they were involved in an accident that caused harm. The actual mental state is that they're aware and they consciously disregard. Criminal negligence is lower, and what that means is that a person fails to be aware of a risk. So they fail to be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur, that the circumstance exists. And so when my legislative committee was discussing the mental states that made sense in order to be essentially broad enough to loop in behavior and conduct that has to do with knowing that you were involved in an accident and therefore you would stay, otherwise if you leave, you've committed a crime, or that you disregarded the likelihood that you had been involved in an accident, maybe because your car clipped something, and the way that the statute's being drafted is you'd have to investigate that. We understand that what you're trying to do is avoid someone clipping that and having reason to believe that they'd been involved in an accident, but they keep going because they'll be able to say, I didn't know. And so we understand what you're trying to get at. The conversation that we had was that recklessness was lower than knowing, and it was low enough to loop in what you're trying to get. Our fear with criminal negligence is that it would be too broad, and you're getting at people who truly don't know, but we think they should have known.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Chair Barker.
Yes,
Representative. So I see that there are some -1 amendments floating right around, but I don't see them posted yet. I don't have the... looking at all of us, I don't see them here yet. Are they here?
They're online, Chair Barker, members of the committee.
They are.
Yeah,
are they? Okay.
If you go under House Bill 4055 on OLS under the Amendments tab.
Mary, this is bothering me for this reason. Mm-hmm. The facts of this case obviously are very compelling, but if the driver in this case had not had her brother, whoever it was, ride his bicycle back up the street, and therefore she really didn't know, we might be able to tag her with negligence, but we probably couldn't tag her with recklessness.
That's right.
And it strikes me that we really should be getting at that negligent piece, mm-hmm, for the very reason that this case shows us. So are the dash ones consistent with what you're asking for? Okay.
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, I think that's a I understand why you're making that statement. And I guess what I can say is at a certain point, some conduct truly is accidental. Some conduct, there are true accidents in the world. And if we are looping in conduct where someone truly didn't know that they were involved in an accident, and we're holding them responsible for that lack of knowledge, I personally think that's problematic. That's a decision for this legislative body to make, but I do think it's problematic. What I believe the statute's trying to do is address the situation where someone truly doesn't know, but they find out later. And so my understanding is it still may not be criminal in nature. That person has, based on the statute that Representative Olson is proposing, someone who truly engaged in accidental conduct, who the statute requires comes back to the scene, that person still may not be criminally liable. And you don't need a criminally negligent mental state to get that person to have to come back to the scene. We're not trying to, I don't think that the statute's actually trying to criminalize people. People will be criminalized if, in fact, there were reasons for them to have not hit someone. So if someone was criminally negligent in the way they drove, or if they were drunk or something like that, I think that's going to be clear that, at that point, the failure to perform duties of a driver statute might not matter. It'll be more, you know, like assault or manslaughter or murder charges even.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Okay, but whether you think that the original activity was negligent or reckless or whatever it was, mm-hmm. what we're trying to get at is the situation that was described here, which is change the circumstances slightly. The children had been injured, but nobody could figure out yet exactly why. And with knowledge of what had happened, we may have been able to have some kind of a treatment afforded mm-hmm. that without that knowledge we couldn't afford. And we're saying it's merely negligent if I hit something, but I'm not sure I was in an accident. I don't know for sure. I'm not going to go back and investigate. No. If you've hit something or if you have any reason to believe you've hit something, the demand we're making on you with the law as we're changing it is that you go find out so that in case your knowledge then added to whatever is happening on the scene can be a benefit to somebody, it's then afforded. And your suggestion doesn't allow us to do that. Your suggestion allows the person to say, not sure, I'm not going to bother to go back, and then they don't become liable. So I don't want to belabor this. I'm just going to put on the record that I think that's a step too far. You know, Mary, that I believe wholeheartedly in vigorous defense in all criminal activity, and I think that the balancing of our prosecution and our defense is an important part of our system. But what I believe you're suggesting goes a step too far, in my opinion.
Chair Barker,
yeah, go ahead,
if I may, Representative Vile, I so absolutely appreciate the conversation that we're having, and that really truly is my point about the type of conversation that actually needs to happen on this bill. Thank you.
And I would just say, I was scared of if we just go to reckless is that I will tell my attorney, gee, I didn't know, and then they'll be arguing. I mean, somebody's responsible. If you hit something, you need to stop and find out what it was. And I think the way the bill is written covers that, and that's what we're trying to accomplish. I, too, want vigorous defense opportunity. I mean, the system will not work if the defense attorney can't use every possible means to get the best, to put up the best defense for their client. But I don't think negligence is too low in this thing, and neither does the Court of Appeals, at least from the case I'm thinking of. But
Mr. Sheriff?
Yes,
very comment. This is a very perplexing issue for me, overlaying the tragedy part of it makes it really hard to have a discussion. But the issue we're talking about is not about the accident, not about the original event.
That's right.
It's about not coming back.
That's right.
And these people, this young woman, we believe is guilty because she lived a half a block away and found out and still didn't come back. But if that person had lived 5 miles away and got home and had no idea that they were in an accident and probably no way to find out, then they weren't guilty of not coming back. So the question is, what makes the difference between the fact that the person lived a half a block away and had every opportunity to find out for the horrible event that had happened, or doesn't live a half a block away and isn't guilty of not coming back because they had no reason to know they should come back? Not being a lawyer, I'm not sure how to deal with that.
So what we're trying to say is if you think you hit something, you have to investigate it. You're responsible. You can't just go on and say, I didn't, you know, it's dark, so I didn't see what I hit, so it doesn't count. It counts.
I understand that, but the law is supposed to be about dealing with human behavior. And the event of somebody being in a position where they were able to find out and ignoring it is a different circumstance than them having done the same terrible thing, run over these girls, probably recklessly going through a pile of leaves, what they shouldn't have done.
Right.
kids having fun. I mean,
but we're not. That's not the. That's not what this bill is about. This bill is about not coming back to investigate. And that's what's troubling me. I mean, they obviously should have come back. There's no question. But if they lived somewhere else, they wouldn't have known that they had done it. Or at least you don't know that they would have known.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, he's kind of touching on the point is connecting the dots. And when you have the evidence that is furnished for you through awareness, which obviously occurred with this 19-year-old girl, she didn't do anything.
Yeah, and she should have.
There was obviously
no
obligation, no responsibility. That's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Brett, yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, so I understand, Representative Greenlick, your dilemma. I was thinking about this as I was listening to the facts of the case. Had she thought that she had hit a balloon in the road and got home and didn't think another thing about it, and nobody had gone up the street and seen that there was really something going on, then she might be able to say, that's not even negligent for me to do it that way, because I have no reason to believe that anything untoward has happened. But once that guy went up the street and then came back, that's at least negligent. And
it's a new crime at that point.
That's the crime. And that is the point at which I think we've got to hold people responsible. And even if she hit the balloon and went 5 miles home and said, you know what, I'm not sure that was a balloon, at that moment, I think she's got a duty to go find out. And if she doesn't act on that duty, it may have consequences for others in the society that we've got to hold her responsible for. So that's where I'm coming from. And I agree, it's a very, very tough call. I'm empathetic to Mary and her folks, but I just have to stick with that position on this one.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you so much, Chair Barker and members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Tough testimony.
So I don't know if the other thing, I don't know, Aaron Knott is here as well as Jennifer Lloyd. If they want us to come up and share anything, they may not. Okay, negative
one.
Yes. So
go from a public hearing into a work session.
So
wait a minute. Excuse me.
No paperwork.
Okay. So we don't have the paperwork here on the amendment, so we're going to have to introduce that later. But the intention of me, anyway, to through the committee, and will be to get the amendment in, and then we will move the bill. So, is there any further discussion, any further business to come before the committee today?
Rep, did you vote on the previous bill?
Yes.
I'd like to.
Okay, Rep, well. Close this work session, reopen the work session on House Bill 482 and offer Representative Post a chance to vote. He was called to another committee. Representative?
Did we do both the amendment? Was there an amendment?
Yeah, we introduced amendment as amended to the floor.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Have the committee stand adjourned. Thank you, committee.